Well, thanks so much, Greg and Miroslav, for that warm introduction. And it really is an honor and a privilege to be the first speaker with you in person in such a long time, and also to be able to speak with you all about a topic which I think is of such vital national and international importance today. So I'm sure you've all seen photos like this, photos of the insurrection, and as theologians and scholars of religion, I'm sure you all took note of the various symbols on display, Christian flags and Jesus banners, but also Confederate flags and a wooden gallows, stars and stripes and don't tread on me flags, and of course, lots and lots of Trump flags. Many secular observers were surprised by this juxtaposition of symbols. They saw apples and oranges, symbols of religion and nationalism, racism and vigilantism, libertarianism and authoritarianism. What Sam Perry and I saw was a fruit cocktail, white Christian nationalism. My talk today is based on our forthcoming book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. The book and my talk is in four parts. First, I'll talk about the ingredients, what's in the fruit cocktail and who's drinking it. Second, I'll talk about the original recipe for the cocktail and how it has changed over time. Third, I'll talk about how it works on the political mind and the effects that it's had over the past several decades. I'll then conclude with some thoughts about the place of religious conservatism in conservative politics, how it's changing and what that portends for American democracy, but also for American Christianity. Let's start with the what question, just what exactly is white Christian nationalism? One way of thinking about it is as a political vision, or in sociology, as a set of attitudes and preferences about politics and policy. That's how my co-author Sam Perry thinks about it. He analyzes survey data, and he's constructed a scale that he uses to measure Christian nationalism and assess its effects. It's based on a series of questions that have been asked in several series over time, and here are those questions. So just how many Christian nationalists are there, and who are they? In an earlier book with Andrew Whitehead, Perry divided survey respondents into four categories based on their scores on the Christian nationalism scale, ranging from rejectors to resistors and accommodators to ambassadors. They then broke these categories down further by religious tradition, and here are the results. Now, let me just highlight a couple of key findings. Roughly half of the American population affirms Christian nationalism to some degree. Almost 90% of evangelicals do so. But so do a surprising number of mainline Protestants, Black Protestants, and Catholics. The crucial takeaway here is this: Christian nationalism and white evangelicalism overlap a great deal, but they are not the same. So just what do Christian nationalists believe? Obviously, they believe that America is a Christian nation, or that it was and should be again. But what else? Well, if they're Christian, white Christian nationalists, they also believe in a strong military. They support the police. They want law and order, but they oppose gun control and government regulation. It goes without saying that they're against government handouts and for free market capitalism. Not really any surprises here, right? That's basically the Republican Party platform. Though it is surprising if you step back for just a moment. After all, what does any of this have to do with Christianity? And yet, ask many conservative white evangelicals, and they will insist that this is just part of a coherent biblical worldview. And that's not the only puzzle here either. Ask a white Christian nationalist if they're racist, and you will definitely get an earful. Like most white Americans, they will loudly insist that they're not biased or prejudiced. Unfortunately, the empirical evidence tells us a very different story. Because Christian nationalism is strongly associated with various indicators of racial animus. Amongst other things, it's correlated with opposition to interracial marriage and adoption, and with support for strong borders and restrictive immigration policies. is also positively correlated with a strong sense of white identity. It's not just a matter of being ideologically or politically conservative then, it's a combination of religious and racial identity. It's a strong claim, I know, but here are some of the receipts. Now, if you take a look at these two graphs, you'll see that they chart the relationship between the degree of Christian nationalism and beliefs about discrimination amongst blacks and amongst whites in America. Now, as you'll notice, Christian nationalism has absolutely no effect on these beliefs amongst blacks. The lines are flat. But there is a highly linear relationship amongst whites. White Christian nationalists believe that blacks face very little discrimination and that whites face a lot of discrimination. And the higher their score on the Christian nationalism index, the more they believe this. That is why Perry and I talk about white Christian nationalism rather than just Christian nationalism. Let's now turn to the when question. That is, when did white Christian nationalism first emerge as a coherent ideology? The short answer, in our view, is 1690. That's not the usual answer. New York Times journalist Michelle Goldberg traces it back to the 1980s. Princeton historian Kevin Cruz to the 1950s. Our argument is that it is much, much older. Before I explain why, though, let's take a second pass at the what question. I, as a historical and cultural sociologist, obviously approach and define white Christian nationalism somewhat differently than Sam Perry does. I argue that it is not just a political vision, it is also a deep story. Now, what do I mean by that? A deep story is like a bare bones movie script, a melodrama with heroes and villains and a predictable plot line. The deep story of white Christian nationalism is simple enough. America was founded as a Christian nation. The founders were Orthodox Christians. The founding documents are based on biblical principles, maybe even divinely inspired. America itself is divinely favored, hence its power and prosperity. But America is threatened by non-whites, non-Christians, and non-Americans on its soil, on its borders. It must therefore be kept white and Christian, or made so again. For some Americans, the story is quite explicit. Crack open the history textbooks used by many Christian academies and Christian homeschoolers, and you'll find it right there in black and white. For many others, though, it's more implicit, a set of almost unconscious assumptions. It goes without saying, doesn't it, that white Christians built America. It simply feels like religious and racial others don't somehow really belong in the United States. It's a story, in other words, that's burrowed very deeply into conservative white culture, hence a deep story. Now, as I said, the deep story is also an old story. In a sense, it's as old as the Christian Bible itself, or rather a certain Puritan Protestant reading of the Bible. Three readings of three stories, to be precise. Perry and I call them the Promised Land story, the End Times story, and the Racial Curse story. In the Promised Land story, the New England Puritans imagined themselves as a new Israel. Over time, they came to see the New World as their promised land, and the native tribes as Canaanites or Amalekites who had to be driven out or destroyed. In the End Times story, the Puritans' wars with the Native Americans were recast as part of a cosmic struggle between the forces of good and evil, the denouement of the eschatological drama in which God's new chosen people confronted hordes of, quite literally, demonic others. Finally, in the racial curse story, Noah places a curse on one of his three sons, Ham. Ham's descendants bear a mark on their body. They are destined for servitude. And where do Ham's descendants settle down? Why, in Africa, of course, which is why Africans are black and why it is God's will that they be enslaved. By 1690, the three key ingredients of white Christian nationalism were ready to be mixed together by Protestant theologians. Cotton Mather was one of the first to serve up the fruit cocktail. His Ecclesiastical History of New England remains, in a sense, the urtext of white Christian nationalism, the original recipe, if you will. Now, white Christian nationalism has evolved over the centuries, and Perry and I distinguish five different phases in its historical development. During the 18th century, it became British rather than English, and Protestant rather than Puritan. Now, in part, this had to do with changes in the British Isles, specifically the union of the English and Scottish parliaments to create the Parliament of Great Britain. It also had to do with the tightening association between British and Protestant identity that followed. But perhaps most important factor were imperial conflicts in North America, particularly between Catholic France and its native allies on the one hand, and the Protestant British and their settler colonies on the other. It was the crucible of war that durably alloyed national, religious, and racial identities in the British colonies, creating white Protestant Britishism. Though contemporaries usually referred to this alloy by a different name, the Protestant interest, it was during the British phase that white Christian nationalism first became entangled with a certain racialized notion of freedom. France and other Catholic monarchies, it was believed, suffered under civil and religious tyranny, while the British and their colonies enjoyed civil and religious liberty. These liberties, however, were defined not only in religious and nationalist terms, but in racial ones as well. For freedom was white freedom, understood in opposition to black enslavement. If the French and Indian Wars generated a British version of white Christian nationalism in the colonies, then it was the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 that compelled the creation of an American version. Let's call it white Protestant Americanism. What supposedly made white American men different from their former British countrymen was that they had a tinge of red in them. That is, that they appropriated certain elements of Indian culture as they understood it. A certain degree of savagery, if you will. The first symbol of this new white American masculinity was the scout, the frontiersman who forged into the wild, learned the ways of the natives, and absorbed a bit of violence and savagery in the process. The hero of James Fenimore Cooper's Longstocking Tales, America's first popular novels, was Natty Bumppo, an Indian scout. Later, of course, the scout would be succeeded by another mythical male figure, the cowboy. If the British version of white Christian nationalism was linked to a certain idea of white Christian, of white Protestant freedom, then the American version was also linked to a certain ideal of white male violence. Now, in the southern states, this association between white freedom and male violence was even stronger. For there, freedom and violence were linked not only by the threat of native war bands, but also by fears of black insurrection, and sometimes also the reality. Much has been made of free blacks who joined the Patriot cause during the Revolution. But there were many more enslaved blacks who joined the British forces in hopes of gaining their freedom, also in the War of 1812. Indeed, the British Marine units that stormed the US Capitol that year included many formerly enslaved blacks. Seen in this context, the third stanza of the Star-Spangled Banner, composed in 1814, appears in a much more sinister light. In other words, the blood of black British soldiers slain by American heroes washed away the pollution left by their bodily presence in the sacred capital. White freedom bought with black blood. Freedom isn't free, as the saying goes. It must always be paid for with violence and bloodshed. A kind of political theology of substitutionary atonement, if you will. To the cocktail of racial, religious, and national identity, then, certain notions of white freedom and righteous violence have now been added. It was a very intoxicating spirit for some. If the 1690s were a formative decade for white Christian nationalism, then the 1890s were a transformative one. The catalyst of the transformation was twofold: the closing of the American frontier and the beginning of the American empire. The result of the transformation was fourfold: changed understandings of whiteness and otherness, divine providence, and national identity. The spirit of 1690 was reborn as the spirit of 1890, the spirit of WASP empire. Whiteness now came in various shades. The brightest white had various names: Aryan, Nordic, Anglo-Saxon, though, was the most common. There were, of course, off-white, brownish shades too: Irish, Italian, Jewish, Slavic, and Magyar. Part of what made them less white was that they weren't often Protestant. Religion could whiten or it could darken. It still can. Not only was white over black, now some whites were over other whites. Otherness also came in various new shades. The racial order of the colonial era was comprised of just three colors: white, red, and black. The new racial order of imperial America added two new shades, brown and yellow. The brown faces of Mexican citizens who suddenly found themselves on American territory, as Texas and California and large swaths of the Southwest were forcibly incorporated into the United States, but also the yellow faces of Chinese and Japanese immigrants to the Pacific coast. These casting changes were not the only changes in the deep story, though. The script itself underwent a number of important modifications. The denouement was now different. It was post-millennial. In this eschatology, of course, the kingdom of God had to be built on earth before the return of Christ. White Americans were still a chosen people, but their task was not just to build a city on a hill in New England, but rather to civilize an entire continent and eventually to spread freedom to the entire planet. This westward movement and its outward successor was all part of a divine plan, a manifest destiny. The fourth and final change was from nation to empire. It went together with a fundamental shift in white American self-conception. They were not just the chosen people seizing a promised land, they were now Christ-like figures spreading freedom. Like Christ, and the Protestant theologians of the era did not hesitate to make this comparison, America was acting purely out of compassion, altruism, and benevolence, never vengefulness, self-interest, or greed. America's motives were always and ever innocent, perfectly so, like those of Christ himself. Even when it employed the most brutal violence, it was simply acting as God's hand. This was the through line connecting all of America's imperial wars, from Spain to Korea and Vietnam, and on to the war on terror, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And who nurtured the new spirit of 1890? Looking back from the present, one might suppose that it was conservative evangelical Protestants, but in fact, it was liberal mainstream Protestants. Many of the sharpest critics of the new spirit were theological conservatives, people such as three-time Democratic presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan. For over three centuries then, from 1690 to 1890, white Christian nationalism was championed by what we now call the Protestant establishment, by prominent white theologians such as Timothy Dwight and Josiah Strong and Shaler Matthews. A century later, in 1989, the torch had been passed on to conservative white evangelicals like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and to Christian colleges such as Liberty University and Hillsdale College. By then, many white liberal Protestants had become secular progressives and also liberal Democrats. Meanwhile, most white evangelicals had become conservative Republicans and also pro-market and pro-military. Why this radical reversal? Contemporary conservatives like to make Roe v. Wade the turning point in the story. But conservative white Protestants did not really become pro-life until the late 70s. The rightward turn of white evangelicals actually began a full quarter century earlier with Brown versus the Board of Education. Opposition to racial integration was the initial catalyst for the rise of the religious right. Family values was just the political cement that Republican strategists used to bind white evangelicals to their old arch enemies, conservative Catholics. How did this changing of the guard influence white Christian nationalism? Conservative white evangelicals made four important revisions to the deep story. First, they reverted to the old premillennialist version of the end times story. In Hal Lindsey's vision, as in Cotton Mather's, America's wars were the front line in a cosmic struggle between good and evil. It was 1690 all over again, except that now the demons were Russians rather than Indians. Second, they gradually shifted from white supremacism to colorblindness. At first, the shift was purely tactical. Instead of shouting the N-word, conservative white leaders now tut-tutted about welfare queens. The curse of Cain was reborn as the culture of poverty. Later, racial reconciliation became the watchword. The only way to address racism, it was said, was to change hearts. Racism was a personal problem, not a social one. Conservative colorblindness was and is a form of anti-racism, a way of deflecting demands for racial justice. The third and final shift was the sexualization of sin. Of course, the focus on sex was not entirely new. It went back to the New England Puritans and their Calvinist forebears. What was new was the near exclusive focus on sex as the most important form of sin, and with it, the focus on the family. For conservative white evangelicals, on the other hand, Christian morality was increasingly equated with sexual morality. The net result of all of these changes was a hyper-aggressive foreign policy and a laissez-faire economic and social policy. That is, a convergence between evangelical theology and Republican policy. Fourth and finally, they did away with the various shades of whiteness and just opted for plain old vanilla. Evangelicalism, after all, originated in the lower class, low church traditions that the WASP elite had long disdained. Too, by the 1950s, there was no doubt that the Irish, the Italians, and even the Jews were white. Which brings us now to my third question, the how question, as in, how does it work in our politics and our culture? The short answer is in concert with white Christian individualism. Like white Christian nationalism, white Christian individualism emerged long ago and has evolved over time. The Puritan warrior is an early example. He built a city on a hill and burned native settlements to the ground. Later examples include the Christian slaveholder, who ruled with a mixture of pious benevolence and brutal violence, or the Christian homesteader, who settled the frontier and slaughtered the natives, or the Cold War evangelical who battled godless communism. All were prepared to use violence to defend their liberty and impose law and order on others. The contemporary version of white Christian individualism is what my fellow sociologist Gerardo Marti has called Christian libertarianism. It emerged during the middle decades of the 20th century and is better known by its nickname, personal accountability. It presumes that one's lot in life is a result and only a result of one's personal choices. Historical and social contexts are completely irrelevant. Wealth or poverty, salvation or damnation, bliss or despair, it is all up to you. But you will also be held to account for your choices, whether by the market, or by God, though to be honest, it's sometimes hard to tell one invisible hand from the other, for a Christian libertarian, anyway. White Christian nationalism and white Christian individualism are like two sides of the same coin. One is the flip side of the other. This is because the deep story of white Christian nationalism always has the same protagonist, a white Christian man. Here's how the coin works. When white Christians make claims on other Americans, they do so in the name of national unity and solidarity. But when racial and religious others make claims on white Christians, those claims are refused in the name of individual rights and personal accountability. In other words, heads, white wins, tails, everybody else loses. Let's take a quick look at contemporary politics to see how this works. Let's start with the Tea Party. Remember them? It does seem like an awfully long time ago now. It all started, though, on February 19, 2009, roughly 1 month after the inauguration of America's first black president. Rick Santelli, a financial reporter with CNBC, delivered a viral rant from the trading floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, in which he blamed the 2008 financial crisis on losers who had taken out mortgages they couldn't afford and excoriated the new president for bailing them out. He then called for the formation of a new Tea Party to resist federal taxation and defend individual rights. Sounds secular and libertarian, right? But here's the thing. As academics and journalists began researching the Tea Party supporters and organizations, they made several important discoveries. Most Tea Partiers turned out to be older white evangelical men, men who were also generally supportive of the idea that America is a Christian nation. Well-known evangelical political activists were centrally involved. Ralph Reed, in fact, formed his Faith and Freedom Coalition to support the Tea Party movement. More, religion was also raced. Tea Partiers were generally opposed to non-white immigration. Indeed, some Tea Party groups even emerged out of white vigilante groups operating along America's southern border. In short, the Tea Party was shot through with white Christian nationalism. Now let's shift our focus to the MAGAverse. In his 2017 inaugural address, President Trump promised that the American people would take back their country. They would band together around Christianity. They would start winning again and saying Merry Christmas again and bring Christianity back because it's a good thing. They would also put America first, restore law and order, build a great wall around the nation to keep out criminals and illegals, and institute a total ban on Muslims. Sounds a lot like white Christian nationalism, right? And indeed, one way of understanding Trumpism is as a reactionary and secularized version of white Christian nationalism. Reactionary in the sense that it abandons the polite rhetoric of colorblindness and American exceptionalism in favor of an older, full-throated racist language about blood and violence. And secularized in the sense that apocalypticism gives way to catastrophizing and good and evil are replaced by friend and foe. Carl Schmitt for the masses, if you will. But just as the Tea Party's libertarian facade hit white Christian nationalism, so too does Trumpism resonate with the holy trinity of white Christian individualism, freedom, violence, and order. First, violence. We all know that Trump is a master of verbal violence. He uses words as weapons to wound his opponents and intimidate his rivals. Crooked Hillary, Sleepy Joe, Lying Ted, Little Marco, Low Energy Jeb. Of course, he is not above threatening or inciting physical violence, as he often did on the campaign trail, and more faithfully on January 6th. And it appears that he has engaged in physical violence against women repeatedly. Now for freedom. When criticized for his intemperate speech, the insults, the threats, the profanity, Trump and his supporters style themselves as defenders of free speech and opponents of cancel culture who dare to be politically incorrect. In other words, they reclaim their God-given right to use racist and sexist language with impunity. as in the good old days of Jim Crow and Mad Men. Finally, order, by which I mean racial order. Trump's response to Black Lives Matter was to call for law and order, which is to say for white male violence, police violence, vigilante violence, even military violence. Meanwhile, his response to white male violence in Charlottesville and Washington was unrepentant words about very fine people and patriotic Americans. And that's how white Christian nationalism and white Christian individualism work together in American politics. Heads, whites win, tails, everyone else loses. Or, in the words of the Brazilian proverb, for my friends, everything. For everyone else, the law. Let me conclude with some thoughts about where we are right now and where we may be headed in the future. The Republican coalition that elected Ronald Reagan, as Miroslav pointed out, is often described as a three-legged stool, composed of neoconservative hawks, pro-market neoliberals, and religious traditionalists. This description is incomplete in at least two ways. It says nothing about the seat that joined the legs, the Cold War fight against godless communism, and it says nothing about the concealed fourth leg of white supremacism and anti-black racism. With the end of the Cold War, the seat of the chair needed to be replaced, and it was replaced in the early 2000s with the War on Terror. The racist leg by then had become something of an embarrassment. So some tried to remove it using the tool of racial reconciliation. But the leg was a structure, a system. It could not be dislodged just by building relationships or changing hearts. Still, the stool was big enough and stable enough to support George W. Bush for two terms and Republican majorities in Congress for even longer. Today, though, the problem is not just the seat, it's the whole stool. It's been shrinking because America's demographics have been changing. Partly because of its racial demographics. The U.S. will soon be a majority-minority country. But also because of its religious demographics. The historic majority, white Protestants, is already a minority. And the fastest growing group is the so-called nuns, those who claim no religious affiliation. It's not clear that the chair is big enough to support a political majority anymore. The chair has not only become smaller, it's also become creakier. The truth is the legs never really fit together. Consider the religious leg once again. Do Christian family values really go together with neoliberal economic policies? Is America really a city on a hill, or has it become a battle to capture a hill and plant a flag? And how can the persistence and even growth of racial inequality be reconciled with biblical concerns for social justice? These tensions were always there, but they were diminished for a time by the widespread prosperity of the post-World War II era. No longer. Then Donald Trump sat down in the chair and it began to splinter under his weight. Christian family values couldn't bear the weight of the porn star president. His racist bullhorn cured some Christians of their colorblindness. Only his attacks on China really joined religious traditionalists to their own allies. Trump himself did not manage to build a new chair, but he did leave behind a rough blueprint. As near as I can tell, it also has four legs. In foreign policy, isolationism, in economic policy, protectionism, in racial matters, nativism, and in social outlook, a mix of cultural Christianity and patriarchal values. The shape of the seat is harder to make out. Perhaps a war against meritocracy, with China as the external enemy and America's professional classes as the internal enemy. This is more or less what you already see in places like Poland and Hungary, where a similar coalition has already installed itself more or less permanently in political power. And this is also why so many conservative intellectuals interested in a, quote, post-liberal future have been making regular pilgrimages to Budapest of late. But America is not Poland and Hungary, which are ethnically and religiously comparatively homogeneous. An America First chair might not be big enough to sustain an electoral majority, not even with the built-in advantages our current electoral system gives to the America First Coalition. Instead of building a bigger chair, though, the America Firsters are trying to engineer a smaller electorate, or simply giving up on democracy altogether. Some America Firsters would, in fact, be quite happy to replace the chair with a throne. Indeed, a few are seriously discussing the idea of an American monarchy. But the more likely scenario, in my view, is what social scientists call Herrenvolk democracy, that is, master race democracy. That is, a parliamentary regime in which the exercise of power and suffrage is restricted, de facto and often de jure, to the dominant group, and in which that group understands itself as a superior race or culture and subjects others to varying degrees of legal repression and extra-legal violence. In other words, Jim Crow 2.0. That is the likely path if the current Republican coalition regains control of Congress in 2022 and the White House in 2024 and is able to manipulate elections thereafter. This is not the only possible scenario. There are at least two others. The first is the survival of liberal democracy, which is to say the status quo ante since the civil rights and voting rights laws of the mid-1960s. The second is the achievement at long last of a multiracial democracy, which is to say a nation of nations and a people of peoples in which these rights are enforced and extended and historic injustice is recognized and perhaps even undone. Which of any, if any of these three scenarios will become reality is hard to say, but I know that I, for one, am rooting for multiracial democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Gorski. We have time for questions. I would ask you, if you would, since you'll listen to all of us, to identify yourself. And my favorite line is, please disguise your comment as a question. be direct, if you would, because there'll probably be a number of people who'd like to pose things. So, the floor is open. Francisco.
So the way I am thinking about it implicitly is in terms of categorical social boundaries. So white versus black, white versus red, et cetera, et cetera. And white Christian nationalism seeks to align these different boundaries with one another, so that being white means being Christian, means being patriotic or native born. So that's part of what it means. Another way of thinking about what I mean is through the kind of metaphor of a shell game, right? You know, you've got the three cups or the three shells, and there's a little red ball. And the way I like to think about it is, sort of imagine, the white Christian nationalist. The little red ball is racism or whiteness, and it's hidden under one of the cups. And, as is always the case, there's somebody who's sort of collaborating in the audience who's sort of a white supremacist. The white supremacist knows that the red ball is there and knows which cup it's under. But, sort of moving things around and constantly shifting code and categories, if you say, well, aren't you talking about race here? No, I'm talking about culture. But wait, aren't you talking about race? No, I'm talking about traditional Christianity. But aren't you talking about race over here? No, I'm really just talking about patriotism, right? So that you really have to understand the way in which the different categories are aligned with one another and the way in which in actual debate and discourse there's this constant code switching going on, which conceals the role that race is playing, except for the person, the white supremacist, standing next to the white Christian nationalism, who knows what the game is actually about. Does that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, the point is, you can only ever understand it, you know, as we like to say, relationally, right? I mean, it's not like this sort of thing or essence, you know? I mean, if you really press me, I don't think there's any such thing as white culture in the sense in which people, Americans, typically imagine white culture. I mean, there, you know, which is some kind of, you know, sort of pure distillation of, I don't know, Nordic or European or whatever culture. You know, imagine how boring life would be if our culture was only formed by Nordic culture, right? I mean, if it didn't have, if it was not hybrid in the ways that in the many ways that it actually is. Right.
And it's grouped in under this white Christian movement. And I suspect other people as well.
So this is something I kind of puzzle over sometimes a little bit too, and I'm not entirely sure what to make it. I mean, I'll just give you a couple of hot takes. So one is, I think that the racial order in America is in flux. And it's in kind of a liminal state right now. And so people who think really hard about this, the way that they'll put it is they'll say, well, I mean, are we just going to have a new version of the black versus white racial order in which, you know, Asians, Latinos, you know, become white or honorary whites? Or are we going to have a sort of a multicolored racial order in which you're sort of white, you know, with, you know, brown as a sort of intermediary category? I mean, that's the way I've heard some folks talk about it. And so, you know, being sort of hyper-patriotic in that way is a sort of way of claiming a certain kind of whiteness, right? I mean, that would be my sort of hot take on it, but, you know, I think it's really hard to say. It's very complicated. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, psychologically complicated, sociologically complicated. I mean, I still, you know, find myself scratching my head about this, you know, guy who, you know, so obviously, you know, presents as Latino, you know, being the head of this white supremacist militia group.
One of your former students.
Hi, Professor Gorski. Hi,
Wade.
I'm Alan Dimikhail, currently dean for Marquand Chapel here at YDS. And I wanted to ask you, I'm fascinated by you and your colleagues' choice to shift the key moment from Roe v. Wade back to Brown versus Board of Education. And I was wondering, are you arguing that primarily because you want to highlight how central race is as opposed to gender and sexual matters, or were there other specific ways in which you saw the narrative shift, the deep story shift earlier than most people claim?
So I think in part it really is just looking more carefully at the sociological and historical evidence. So, you know, the sociological evidence is opinions about choice and abortion amongst conservative white Protestants. And, you know, as I said very quickly in my talk, those shift much later than I think most people realize. I mean, it's long after Roe v. Wade, and, you know, there's lots of historical work that shows, you know, that there were many sort of pro-choice, as we would now put it, pro-choice, you know, pastors, theologians in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You know, it was a, quote, Catholic issue. Abortion was seen as a Catholic issue, in part because of anti-Catholic animus. You know, it was something that, you know, was not taken on board. And the other, the historical evidence is just that, you know, we know more about sort of meetings and strategic decisions that were made amongst sort of conservative political and religious operatives in the late 50s and the early 60s. And it just becomes really, really clear, you know, and some of them will just say this, that, you know, what really bothered them was, you know, desegregation. That was, Now, I mean, I think retrospectively, I think, you know, in being fair, I think you do have to say that people who are, you know, anti-abortion, you know, come often from a very principled theological and moral perspective. And, you know, that they may have come to that later, and you can't, you know, sort of see that. You know, I think there really was sort of a shift over time amongst conservative white Protestants. I mean, I think there are some, you know, for some, it really is much more about, you know, a certain kind of family model and a certain gender order. But I think, you know, for some, it's also really a kind of a principled moral stand. But if you're really sort of trying to understand, like, why does this initial shift happen? What, you know, why do you suddenly have conservative white evangelicals in the South beginning to align with Northern urban Catholics? You have to look at the race issue. It's just absolutely, it's absolutely crucial. It really is the crucial turning point. And there's a lot of very good revisionist scholarship that's come out about this. I mean, Randall Balmer's book is just the most recent recent example.
Yes.
So that's a great question. I guess I should start by saying that I think the Puritans are very complicated people. You know, whom I admire in some ways and not so much in others, and that this kind of version of white Christian nationalism is not something that is, in my view, really central to and distinctive of like the first generation so much of Puritan settlers is really sort of the second and the third generations. You can see this in a way in the history of the Mather clan, you know, Cotton being the third of the, you know, of the well-known Mather theologian. That'd be the first thing that I would say. But I think it is absolutely right that there is a sort of attempt to claim, you know, the Puritans as sort of the true or the first founders of the United States. And there's kind of a sort of a highbrow and a lowbrow version of this. So, you know, kind of the highbrow version, you would see more with, you know, kind of sorts of theologians that I would, you know, more recently associate with the kind of, you know, young, restless, reformed types, you know, kind of highbrow, reformed, or neo-reformed theologians, who can make a sort of a credible claim to being, in some sense, in the intellectual lineage of the Puritan. But I think, you know, for a lot of them, it's a lot. There's also the kind of the lowbrow version. It's just about, oh, you know, the Puritans, Thanksgiving, right? You know, they came here for religious freedom, et cetera, right? So that would be my kind of quick take on it. Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. I mean, I had have mostly thought about in this way that I was describing earlier, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, the Proud Boys. And but, you know, I have also run across stories like this, you know, of folks who were, you know, fleeing war, who were refugees, who were, you know, victims of anti-Christian violence, for example, and other parts of the world, and feel like, in a sense, that they were kind of saved or rescued by the American military. And those are definitely much more complicated cases. You know, I mean, the world's messy. There's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's just not going to fit into my nice, neat little account and theory here. And you know, I think that you brought up a really important and interesting case that I'll need to think about a little bit more. So thanks for that.
Last question. That at least alignment and identification with evangelicalism grew under the Trump administration, but it didn't shrink. And so how can you talk a little bit more about the methodological questions that go into defining something as slippery and ill-defined and non-monolithic as evangelicalism?
Right, right. Yeah, it's a moving target that's hard to get a hold of. And it's something that people like Sam Perry, or, you know, people at Pew or PRI fret about a lot. I mean, there are sort of two basic ways in which survey researchers try to get at who evangelicals are. You know, one is just by self, or I guess I should say three. One is just self-identification. You know, are you evangelical? Yes, no. Another one is to say, well, you know, evangelicals tend to believe the following things. People who answer, yes, I believe in these four or five things, well, we'll define them as an evangelical. And the third way is say, well, there are certain, you know, traditions or styles of Christian organization or worship that tend to be associated with what we think of as evangelicalism, or to understand themselves as evangelical. And so we'll just kind of by fiat decide that anybody who belongs to this denomination or this kind of church is an evangelical. And I think anybody who really does this for a living knows that you're gonna get somewhat different results depending on which of these approaches you use. And I think that they also understand, again, that especially now, that the evangelical label itself is contested and fluid. You know, there's, just to give an example, I think that you were, two examples, one that you referenced and another that's been discussed a lot. I mean, the first is the growth in the number of evangelicals. I mean, the people I know who've actually looked more deeply into this data, it mostly has to do with people who don't really attend church all that much suddenly saying they're evangelical. And I mean, this is something that was already being picked up 5 or 10 years ago, where there's, you know, for many people, evangelical is increasingly a kind of a ethnic, cultural, or political label. And so I think like the most striking example of this is that you will find people who say that they're Hindu, or that they're, or even if they're Muslim, who will identify as evangelical on a survey, right? Which is, you know, right? So that's part of what's going on. And I think also just, you know, the label is, you know, even people think of themselves as evangelical. There's just a lot of, you know, upheaval going on right now. And there are some people who are disidentifying with the label, even if they aren't really changing, you know, their fundamental theological beliefs. So another, I think you can see this in another finding that was discussed recently. I think this is a PRI finding that in their latest survey, the number of mainstream Protestants, people who are defined as mainstream Protestants, actually increased and was reached rough parity with self-identified evangelicals. And you know, like a lot of liberal Protestants are like, gay, right? But it's hard to know what this means. It could, because a lot of people who get coded as evangelical are actually sitting in the pews of mainstream Protestant churches. And if they just suddenly decide to tell the person from PRI who calls them up that they're not evangelical anymore, they haven't changed what they believe, they're still going to the same church, but that shows up in the survey data as growth in liberal Protestantism. So for me, I think really the fundamental takeaway here is that it was always difficult to measure and to figure out who is an evangelical, and because of the incredible sort of flux and upheaval that we're in the middle of right now, it's even more difficult. The last thing I will say, and I think this is an important point, is, you know, sometimes like when Sam presents this data, you know, people say, well, you know, I don't, you know, I'm a conservative white evangelical and I don't know anybody like that. Well, maybe you don't, you know, because, you know people who are like you. Maybe you don't even know the people who are sitting, you know, two pews over from you very well, say nothing of the people who, you know, are worshiping on the other side of the highway. You know, that the fact that this data doesn't seem true to your experience doesn't mean it's not true. I mean, there are just piles and piles of evidence and survey data validating these points. I mean, you know, Sam has published, I think, like 100 articles, literally, on white Christian nationalism over the last five years, just, you know, again and again and again, validating the same results, you know, with different survey data, with different methodological approaches, with different statistical models. I mean, it just can't be brushed away. It just can't be brushed away, even if it's not true to your personal experience.